We are in search of the real God, the God whom Jesus came to make known to us. They were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking ahead of them, and they were amazed, and those who followed were fearful. And again, he took the 12 aside and began to tell them what was going to happen. We are going to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death, and will deliver him to the Gentiles. They will mock him, spit on him, and scourge him, kill him, and 3 days later he will rise again. Now James and John, the two sons of Zebedee, came up to him, saying to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." And he said to them, "What do you want me to do?" They said, "Grant that we may sit in your glory, one on your right and one on your left." And Jesus said, "You don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized?" And they said to him, "We are able." Jesus said to them, "The cup that I drink, and you shall be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized. But to sit on my right or on my left, this is not mine to give. It is for those for whom it has been prepared." And hearing this, the 10 began to feel indignant with James and John. And calling them to himself, Jesus said, "You know that those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. But it is not so among you, but whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you shall be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." May God bless this reading of his holy and infallible Word. Surely the grass withers and the flower fades, but not the Word of God. No, the Word of God stands forever. Be seated, please. If you'll take your sermon outline, you'll notice that the first thing we're going to talk about is a radical problem. A radical problem. Milton Rakic is a psychologist who wrote a book about three patients that were institutionalized in Ypsilanti, Michigan. Their names were Clyde and Leon and Joseph. Clyde and Leon and Joseph had a psychotic delusional disorder of a grandiose nature. You see, Clyde and Leon and Joseph all thought they were Jesus. They all thought they were the reincarnated Christ. His book is called The Three Christs of Ypsilanti. In his attempt to bring some relief or progress to these three men, he decided that perhaps it would help if they were entirely put together. So he had these three men sleep in the same quarters, work together, eat all their meals together, in the same small group together, so they would never be separate from each other. It led to some very interesting conversations, as he details in his book. For instance, as they're sitting in small group, he'd say to one, "Who are you?" And he would say, "I am a messenger from God. I have come to save the world. I am on a mission from God." And the counselor would say, "Well, how do you know that?" And he'd say, "Well, God sent me." To which one of the others would say, "No, I did not." I guess the challenge for us is to realize that there's a little bit of Messiah complex in all of us. You see, these three men, for some reason, found it necessary to distort reality and see themselves as the absolute center of the universe. I think we have a proclivity to do that as well, to see all of life as revolving around us. Now, it won't get us institutionalized, but it will rob life from us if we persist in seeing life as being about us. Now, we don't tend to see this real clearly in ourselves necessarily, but we do see it very clearly in others. In Mark chapter 10, we see it most clearly in who? And the disciples, particularly in James and John. Jesus announces in Mark chapter 10, verse 32, 33, He announces something dramatic. He says, we're going to Jerusalem, and when we get there, I'll be taken, I'll be beaten, and I'll be executed. Now, if you were with Him and you were one of His friends, or one of your friends told you something like that, how might you at least want to respond? How might you expect that you would respond? You would say what? Don't go. Is there anything we can do? What can we do? We're not going to let this happen. What, you know, this is wrong. This is terrible. How can we help? And yet we read that James and John's response was, upon Jesus' announcement of His coming death, their response was, Lord, will You do for us whatever we ask? It sounds like what a four-year-old might ask. Will You buy anything I ask? Will You do for us whatever You ask? And we know that this was a self-centered question, because the other disciples became what? Indignant over it. Will You do for us whatever we ask? When You come in Your glory, can we get the prime spots on the right and on the left? We see in the disciples, isn't it interesting that Jesus as well puts His disciples in a small group and has them take all their meals together, sleep together, and never be apart for 3 years? Because one of the best ways to get people to realize that our orientation in life is to be all about ourselves is just to put us together. And it will become manifestly obvious. We see it in the disciples. We often see it in other people. Take athletes, right? The Tampa Bay Buccaneers just cut loose one of their so-called star performers, right? Some people called him not Keyshawn Johnson, but Meshawn Johnson, for his self-centered proclivities. Think of the boxing promoter Don King, who was heard to say, I never cease to amaze myself. And I say that humbly. We see this self-centered orientation perhaps as much in this season of the year as any other. Did any of you go shopping on Friday? You could get run over in the parking lot with people driving with the Christmas spirit. If you happen to be contending for one of those bargain items, you could have experienced me first ism in full bloom. If you're in Home Depot or you're in a store like that, how many of you often experience that you're talking to someone there, soliciting their help for some item you want to find, and somebody else will walk up and interrupt? I suggest it must happen about every minute to the people who work there. Somebody interrupts, essentially announcing, I'm here, I have a timetable, I have something I want, and I insist that you regard me first. I think the whole Christmas season can be beset with that spirit if we're not careful. Even people who are very giving at Christmas, we can say, I'm very giving, I'm not about me. But there can be a great desire for people to have a good Christmas. I want to really have a warm, good Christmas. I want my kids home, or I want my kids to appreciate me. I want to feel that. I want to see that the people around me, I want to feel love from other people. Going to church, frankly, is a place where me first often blooms. You would not know how many people can walk out of a service and say, and announce what they didn't like that took place that morning. Because after all, going to church is about me. Now, here's the challenge, is to see this in ourselves, and to realize it affects all of us, and that we're all bent this way. The question is, how do we change? How do we achieve a healthy self-forgetfulness? How do we experience an appropriate smallness? That we think a whole lot less of ourselves. A Copernican revolution of the soul, as one author put it. You know who Copernicus was? He was the Polish astronomer who rightly posited that the whole universe doesn't revolve around the Earth. In fact, the universe revolves around the sun, which means quite literally that you're not what? The center of the universe. How does that happen inside of a person? How does some sort of revolution happen inside of a person that transforms us so that we really could become people who are radically about others? I tell you, it won't come easy, will it? Would it be aided if somebody would just come along and challenge you to be less selfish? Well, we don't think so, and yet we do need that. We do need somebody to reorient our thinking about life. Didn't Jesus stand up and tell us that the one who is first will be what? Last, and the one who's last will be first. The one who exalts himself will be humbled, and the one who humbles himself will be exalted. So somebody's got to reorient our thinking so that we look at life completely differently. But let me tell you something. Just words won't transform our hearts. Perhaps it's an example. What if we had an example to follow? Somebody to show us how to do it. Will that change us? Well, an example is valuable. Everybody knows that. If you're a teacher's teaching, if he can do more than just say it, if he can actually demonstrate it, well, that's helpful. But, you know, true words and a true example will still not change our hearts. It's going to take something far more radical than that. So we got a big problem. Second, I want you to note the radical path. The radical path that's offered to us. You know, James and John were critical of them, but they did have something right. If you knew that a stock was going to take off when the stock market opened on Monday, and you knew that, there was no gamble involved, and I mean it was going to skyrocket, then you'd be wise to invest heavily. If you knew that a massive storm was going to strike our area and there was one building that would remain standing, it'd be wise for you to do what? Get inside that building. Link your future well-being to that building. James and John realize that Jesus is going to come into His glory and that to link themselves to Jesus is the safe place to be. It's the wise place to be. It's the smartest investment of their future. What they don't realize is the cost that's involved. It's fascinating because Jesus actually asked them, doesn't He? He said, you don't know what you're asking for. When you ask to sit on my right and my left in glory, you really don't know what you're asking for. Are you willing to drink the cup of suffering that I'm going to drink? Are you willing to be baptized with the baptism of suffering that I'm going to experience? And what's their immediate response? No problem. We are able. Oh, it should remind you of Peter. Lord, they'll all run away from you, but not me. I am able. Now, it's a radical path. The path to glory for Jesus entailed suffering and sacrificial service. We watched a lot as a family a week or two ago, the History Channel, leading up to the 40th anniversary of the slaying of President Kennedy. And, that the shock and the tragedy of that event made me think as I was looking at this message, Jesus announces His execution in detail before it happens. Imagine if John Kennedy got off the plane at Love Field knowing what awaited him in less than an hour. Imagine if he got into the limousine without any top. Imagine if he went through that parade route the whole way knowing that when he turned on Elm Street, an assassin lay in wait in the school book depository and that shots would ring out and those shots would take his life. Imagine not only that he knew it that day, suppose he knew it months before. And yet he stayed on the same path, and he actually allowed his path to crisscross that very place where those bullets would strike him and his life would be taken. We would be awed by that, wouldn't we? He walked right into his death. He knew it was coming. He didn't flinch. He didn't run. That's Jesus. He takes the path of suffering, the suffering servant, the sacrificial one, the king who serves. Go figure. The world knows nothing like it. In the movie The Last Emperor, there's a scene in which this little fawned over child who's being raised as royalty, the hope of a people. And every wish and every pampering he receives. And he's actually trying to explain to one of his playmates that whatever he wants, he can have. Everybody just does whatever he, you know, and the playmate just knows him as a peer, as a childhood friend. This could not be so. So to prove it, the young emperor takes a priceless vase and he smashes it on the ground. And his handlers run in and they're aghast and they're angry. And so they quickly take one of the other servants and they beat the servant for what he's done. And the boy is proud. Look, I can do anything. I have impunity. You know what the story of the gospel is? It's just the opposite. The servants, like us, commit the sin, but the king gets beaten. Jesus the King came to be a servant, came to take the lowest place. This is the path to glory. And so, Mark chapter 10, what do we read? Are you able to drink the cup? If you want to be great, you must be radically different from the way men and women ordinarily act. You must serve others, whatever the cost. You must drink the cup, whatever it costs, and the cost will be great. Look at verses 43 and 44. Whoever wishes to be great among you shall be what? Shall be a servant. Whoever wishes to be first shall be what? Does it just say slave or slave to all? Can you imagine how hard it is to be a slave to the people you love? Slave to those who despise you. Slave to those you find distasteful and unattractive. A slave to all. That's the calling. That's the path. That's the way to glory. A slave. No rights. Living for the good of others. You know what? Something in our hearts all resonates to say, that is true. That is the way to live. But it's a lot easier to talk about it than do it, isn't it? I think of the man whose wife came to him and said, please, would you please take the kids for this weekend? I am about to lose it. Big time. It's up to here. I just need a break. To which he responded, true story, to which he responded, I would love to, but I can't. Don't you remember? I've got that conference I'm going to on how to be a Christian husband. We read about it, we study about it, we acknowledge it, we affirm it, but to actually get our hearts to do it, boy, that's a whole other ballgame. How do we actually lay down our lives for other people? Hey, you know what? God enables it because it's happening. I see it happen all over this church. I stand here amazed week by week, the people who pour in here, sharing food, doing maintenance tasks, tutoring students, providing scholarships, visiting in the hospital, going to prison, leading Bible studies and worship and nursing homes, caring for widows, taking sick neighbors and friends to the doctor. It's staggering, the service that takes place. Beautiful. Nicholas Kristof is a liberal who writes for the New York Times. I was a little redundant there. And is an editorial writer, and he really loathes Christians. He just drips venom when he describes right-wing, anti-abortion, right self-righteous, negative, angry, Christians. So imagine my surprise a month or two ago when the title of his editorial in the New York Times was Evangelical Christians. Evangelicals are saving Africa. As much as he hated to admit it, wherever he goes in Africa, this continent ravaged by AIDS, he asks, who's feeding the babies? Who's adopting the orphans? Who's establishing homes to care for them? Who's caring for women with AIDS who are destitute and impoverished? Who is leading the fight for women's rights? This one really galled them. Who are the leading feminists of Africa? He says, everywhere I go, it's evangelical Christians. It's a beautiful thing when even the cynic has to take off his hat and say, I see something out of these people I don't see anywhere else, from anyone else. What produces that? But here's the last point. It's a radical path we're called on to lay down our lives for other people. What produces that? It's a radical provision from God. You see, we're afraid. In our heart of hearts, we want to give ourselves. We want to give ourselves to our kids. We want to give ourselves to our spouses. We want to give ourselves to our church. We want to give ourselves to God. We want to give ourselves to other people. We love that to be true of us. In our heart of hearts, we want to be that. But we're also afraid. We're afraid that if we're so giving that, I mean, if we serve, who'll serve us? I read about a man this week. He's so charitable. He's so giving. He's given away millions. He even snuck in the hospital a couple weeks ago and gave one of his kidneys away. He found the most destitute person he could find on the donor recipient list. And he said, literally, why should I have two when other people don't have any that work? Wow. Now, immediately, he snuck in the hospital because his wife wouldn't agree. Her concern was what? And maybe a legitimate one, by the way. Her concern was, what if we need it? What if someone in our family needs it? You see, how can we give away what we might need? I mean, how can we serve freely? Who's going to take care of us? Who's going to serve us? Isn't the answer found right here in Mark chapter 10? What's the answer? The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. Here's the one who will serve you. I want you to listen closely to what I'm about to say. Why did Jesus come to serve? Because he came to reveal the true God, and service is at the heart, the very nature of the true God. We can become servers of others because there is one committed to serve us. God the servant. That's precisely who God is. He is a servant. Jesus reveals the character of God to us. If you think Jesus is a good example, and you think Christianity is an invitation for you to follow Jesus' example, then your Christianity is not good news. Your Christianity is stifling and suffocating. Because I pray that you know that you cannot be like Jesus. If I were to challenge you to be like Jesus, you ought to feel crushed and choked by that. Because guess what? You ain't Jesus. You're not even close. You'll do nothing but fail in your effort. Jesus, our example, is not the gospel. That wouldn't be good news at all. Christianity then would be just a moral improvement program. The good news is that Jesus came to serve his followers, to serve all those who are willing to stop trying to earn his approval by serving him. He came to serve all who would humble themselves like little children and let him serve them. This is the heart of Christianity. It's not that we serve God, because guess what? He's never been lonely. He's never been depressed. His car never breaks down. He has no need by which we would ever serve him. He is not glorified by recruits who want to help him out. The heart of Christianity is not our serving God, but it is coming as children and allowing him to serve us. You did not set this table. You did not cook the meal. You did not provide it. You have made what contribution to this? Nothing in my hands I bring. Guess who that's hard for? It is tremendously hard for us to be served. I was with my dear dad this week. He's in his 80s now. And there's some ways in which his health is failing, and lots of things he can't do that he used to be able to do. And one thing I noticed when I was at their home was some maintenance that needed to be done. So I went out and with the pressure cleaner and began to clean a deck in the back of their house. And as I was doing it, my father would come out and tap me on the shoulder. And what do you think he would say? Don't do that. Don't do that. I'll take care of it. I'll do it myself. Now, Dad's got a bad back. The deck was really slippery when it was wet. He had no business being out there. It was endearing that he wants to take care of what he could have once done so easily. But it is a very difficult thing, isn't it, to be served. We like a Christianity where we serve God. We like a Christianity where we're useful. We like a Christianity where we can earn God's favor. It's a much more difficult thing for us to embrace the gospel, which says you come with nothing. You come and God serves you. Can you come like a little child? Can you come bringing nothing? Can you come where God's the servant? Christ becomes our servant, and all His commands are no longer things we do for Him, but things He enables us to do for others. The Christian life is a life of serving others in the strength that He supplies as our servant. It is loving others with the love He gives us as our servant. Some revolution is going to have to take place in your heart, in your life, and in mine, for us to be servants to others. To be a servant, we must experience being what? Served. You remember when this meal was set? You remember what happened? Jesus came in and He hiked up His garments and He tied them off and He got a basin and He got a towel and He fell on His knees. And what did He do? He began to wash His disciples' feet. And what did they think of that? What does Peter say? You will not wash my feet. I refuse to be served by you. Oh God, show us our hearts. We're a lot like Peter. No, I love church. I get to serve God. No. That's not the gospel. He serves us. Jesus says to Peter, if I don't wash your feet, then you have no part with me. Then, Lord, wash all of me. Can you say the same? Let's pray.